On this edition for Sunday, August 9th, questions about the president's powers after his executive orders, the risk of speeding up the census count. Six years after Ferguson, the legacy of Michael Brown's killing. And what may be the end of an era for political conventions. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular has been offering no-contract wireless plans designed to help people do more of what they like. Our U.S.-based customer service team can help find a plan that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thank you for joining us. The day after President Trump signed four different documents on COVID-19 economic relief, both critics and supporters are trying to figure out what is possible and what is legal. Democratic leaders called the executive actions unconstitutional and said they won't provide necessary relief to Americans. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer criticized the president's plan to provide $400 in weekly emergency unemployment benefits, $200 less than the benefit that expired 1 week ago. States would also have to pay 100 of those dollars.
This is an unworkable plan. Most states will take months to implement it because it's brand new. It's sort of put together with spit and paste. And many states, because they have to chip in $100 and they don't have money, won't do it.
Yesterday, the president said one of the orders would provide a temporary payroll tax cut, which he said would become permanent after the election.
If I'm victorious on November 3rd, I plan to forgive these taxes and make permanent cuts to the payroll tax. I'm going to make them all permanent.
The executive order Mr. Trump signed defers payroll taxes but does not cut them, meaning employers and workers could still be responsible for paying them later. Payroll taxes help fund Social Security and Medicare. And today, White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow tried to clarify what the president meant when he said the cut would be permanent.
When he referred to permanent, I think what he was saying is that the deferral of the payroll tax to the end of the year will be made permanent. It will be forgiven.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she hopes that the White House will come back to the negotiating table and did not commit to a legal challenge.
Right now, we want to address the needs of the American people. My constitutional advisors tell me they're absurdly unconstitutional.
I spoke with political reporter Caitlin Emma, who is covering the president's actions. Caitlin, when we saw the president lay out his executive orders yesterday, one of the first questions was, what is within his rights and his powers to do versus Congress that approves spending?
These executive orders, and I think it's worth noting that actually only one of them is an executive order. The rest were memorandums. In a sense, they carry a little bit less weight in that way, but you know, certainly, I think we're already seeing some of these, orders, memos, kind of in the legal crosshairs. So it's certainly, there are definitely a lot of questions, I guess, about the legality of some of the things that he's proposing here.
In one of the Q&As with reporters, he said, we've got plenty of money that we haven't spent yet. How much money are we talking about? And can it fund all of the things that we're trying to get funded?
You know, states have only spent about a quarter of the money that they received through the CARES Act, which was about $150 billion. And that's become a popular Republican talking point in these negotiations and arguing that, you know, more state and local aid isn't necessary. And look, all these states have all this money that they haven't spent. But that really varies wildly across states. And a lot of the money that hasn't been spent is already spoken for in that it's been allocated for a specific purpose. So asking governors to pick up any part of the tab for unemployment benefits is going to be a very difficult ask, especially when they say that they're already grappling with inadequate levels of federal aid.
Finally, regardless of what negotiators in Washington agree to or not, what that check level is, when does it actually get to people who right now might really need that $600 to pay rent or pay for food?
It's really unclear when these supposed payments would go out. It's unclear how many states would be able to pick up the tab for the rest of the $400 a week payment. Now, this is it's a very uncertain situation at the moment, both in terms of legality and when some of these things would actually take effect to potentially help people.
Caitlin Emma from Politico, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
As political leaders grapple over economic relief, the United States reached a grim milestone in the coronavirus pandemic. There are now more than 5 million confirmed infections in the U.S., by far the most in the world. The death toll is now more than 162,000. According to researchers at Johns Hopkins University, the number of daily infections is falling on average from highs experienced in mid-July. Globally, the number of confirmed cases is approaching 20 million. But the virus is not spreading everywhere. Today, New Zealand marked 100 days without a domestic transmission of coronavirus. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern warned against complacency, even as many in New Zealand have returned to normal life.
100 days is a milestone to mark, but again, we still need to be vigilant regardless.
5 days after a massive explosion in Beirut, international donors pledged today to help the city recover, even as Lebanon descends into a deepening political crisis. At an emergency donors teleconference today, attended by President Trump and dozens of other leaders, French President Emmanuel Macron said world powers must put aside their differences and support the Lebanese people with financial aid. A top American official says the U.S. will provide $15 million in assistance. The pledges of assistance come a day after huge protests in Beirut. Yesterday, thousands set fires and stormed government buildings carrying nooses and banners saying resign or hang. Protesters accuse government officials of negligence and corruption, which they blame for the explosion that injured thousands and killed more than 160 people. Today, Afghanistan officials agreed to release 400, quote, hardcore Taliban prisoners, signaling the beginning of peace talks that could end more than 19 years of war in the country. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani addressed the country's Grand Assembly, which approved the release. The move, supported by the U.S., means the Afghan government has fulfilled its pledge to release 5,000 Taliban prisoners. The peace deal signed by the Taliban and the U.S. in February called for this release, and today the Taliban welcomed the decision. A spokesperson said talks could begin as early as next week. In Belarus today, the president is projected to have won in a landslide after an unusually contested election. President Alexander Lukashenko, called Europe's last dictator, faced one of the biggest challenges to his 25-year rule. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya emerged as a surprising rival, deciding to run after her husband was barred from being a candidate and jailed. International observers have not deemed this a free and fair election, and there are allegations of vote rigging. For the latest on elections in Belarus and other international and national news, visit pbs.org/newshour. Six years ago today, Michael Brown, a young unarmed black man, was shot and killed by a police officer in the streets of Ferguson, Missouri. Though questions still remain about what happened that day, the protests and the movement that it sparked have changed the course of civil rights in the U.S. Brittany Farrell is a St. Louis-based activist and organizer for the political advocacy group Black Futures Lab. NewsHour Weekend correspondent Yvette Feliciano spoke with her about the Ferguson protests and about how the killing of Michael Brown led us to where we are today.
First off, I want to ask you, to take us back to 2014. How did the shooting of Michael Brown initially impact the Ferguson community, and how did it change your life?
I was actually in New York on a vacation with some peers that I was currently at the time in undergrad with. I found out about Mike Brown's murder when I opened up Twitter, and another peer of mine who was here had tweeted, "Ferguson Police Department just shot and killed an unarmed black boy." And it was that moment that I was just instantly glued to my phone. Even from hundreds of miles away, The grief and the pain and the anger that the community was feeling was palpable. Like, it was so strong, you know, the response that folks had to such an atrocious act of violence. That is what urged me to book my trip home the very next day. It rocked our communities. It rocked our communities. And when people here gathered to grieve, and when folks were met with violence, the response to that from the community, the response to the police violence from the community was that we're not going to let you kill us in the street and then tell us that we can't grieve. And it was that response that sent this ripple effect around the world, where the civil rights movement that we are now living in has emerged from.
What are your thoughts about how the media covered the protests? You know, many people outside of Ferguson saw images of fires and destruction to property, and viewed the protests largely as riots. You know, how is that different from what you saw and experienced on the ground?
You know, the framing of our movement, the framing of our uprising at that time, it really, they needed to control the narrative. So in order to do that, they pit the protesters, peaceful demonstrators, folks who were having vigils, who were met with violence, as the rioters, as the looters, as the dangerous ones, and the police were framed as being heroic, trying to save the community from destroying their own community. It was very clear what they were trying to do. We see it today, right? When Donald Trump, he calls the protesters rioters and looters. It's a very important part of his message, because it gives validation to the fact that federal agents get to snatch people off the streets and no one should be concerned about it. Like, it's a repetitive theme that I believe the media in the past has used a lot, and that people get to hold on to continue to perpetuate this narrative that police are necessary, violence against protesters is necessary, because all they do is riot and loot. There's no purpose and for them being out in the streets, and that's just inaccurate. And I'm actually very happy to see now, 6 years later, that people are beginning to see how inaccurate that actually is.
Back in 2014, former officer, police officer Darren Wilson was not indicted for Michael Brown's killing, and he was cleared of any civil rights violations. What impact did that have on your activism and on the national movement that was sparked by this incident?
I felt a sense of rage and anger and deep sadness and grief all at the same time. And it was in that moment that I knew for the rest of my life, my work was going to be geared towards fighting for the justice and dignity and power for Black communities. And I have been on that same trajectory since then. Ever since the non-indictment came out in November of 2014, folks here, and I would feel safe to say around the globe, have not stopped mobilizing, have not stopped moving in pursuit of justice for Black people in this country.
We're once again in a period of widespread protests surrounding the killings of unarmed Black people by the police. You know, 6 years later, why are we back here again? Is there anything about this moment that feels different to you?
Yes. This moment, it feels different, definitely. We have shifted in how we interrogate power over the past 6 years, and we have also began to reimagine justice. It's no longer arrest the cops that killed Breonna Taylor. It's also defund the police and invest money into communities that need that type of investment, Black communities, invest in things to help Black people thrive.
How do you sustain a movement such as Black Lives Matter? What more needs to happen to truly shift policy and people's consciousness?
I believe that this movement is going to continue moving forward because we have to. We know that the only other option at this point, what it looks like, is we are on the pathway to a dictatorship. America is falling into fascism. Is that what we want for our country? Absolutely not. I think that we have no other choice but to organize around a message, Black Lives Matter, because we know that if Black folks have justice in this country, everybody has justice in this country.
Brittany Farrell of Black Futures Lab, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This past week, the U.S. Census Bureau suddenly announced that it will end all counting for the 2020 census on September 30th, a full month earlier than scheduled. The critical count requires that all people living in the U.S. be counted, and efforts to get responses are being slowed down during the coronavirus pandemic. I spoke with NPR reporter Hansi Lo Wang earlier this week about this census count and the decision to move up the deadline. Hansi, what does a shortened amount of days that the Census Bureau will knock on doors mean?
This means the Census Bureau has even less time than it was trying to really finish the count of every person living in the country. Now, right now, roughly 4 out of 10 households nationwide have not been counted yet. And these remaining households are what the Census Bureau considers the hardest to count. These are populations that have been historically undercounted. They include people of color, renters, rural residents, groups that are not likely to fill out a form on their own. And that's why this door knocking that's about to roll out nationwide next week, that door knocking is so critical to making sure that no one is left out and no resident is left out of the count.
Now, that's hard enough as it is. Lay on top of that a pandemic where people are scared to be within a few feet of one another.
Yeah, door knocking is the largest, most expensive operation because it is really hard work, and trying to do it while socially trying to keep social distance, that's very hard, and having enough PPE and trying to overcome people's public health concerns. But now to do that in a short amount of time, in the middle of hurricane season, as well as weeks after the Trump administration, after President Trump issued a memo calling for unauthorized immigrants to be excluded from, not the census in general, but specifically from the census numbers used to reapportion seats in Congress, that's causing a lot of confusion, a lot of outreach campaigns are saying, confusion amongst folks, even though the Constitution says accounting of the whole number of persons in each state, that's the number that should be used to reapportion seats in Congress, and even though there are federal laws that say a person's personally identifiable information cannot be used against them by any federal agency or in court.
So, you know, you have been following this beat for quite some time now, and there was the sort of drama about the citizenship question. Then obviously came the pandemic, and here we are thinking about apportionment. What kind of power does that leave in the hands of the president, even if he were to lose this election?
You know, first thing, I think it should be very clear, there is no citizenship question on the 2020 census. The federal courts have blocked that from being added to the forms. However, the Trump administration has moved forward with this memo calling for the Commerce Secretary to try to figure out a way to exclude unauthorized immigrants from the apportionment count. And you know, here's one thing to keep in mind here, by not extending the counting, by not extending the deadlines for reporting the census results, what this means is that by the end of this year, under federal law, the president will receive the latest state population counts. That is what the Census Bureau right now is working towards. And those are the state population counts. Those are the numbers that President Trump, through his memo, says he wants to exclude unauthorized immigrants from.
The census has to be completed by a certain time, right? So if this does not go well, is there some sort of statistical threshold where the census takers can just say, look, we actually don't have an accurate picture of who's in this country beyond a reasonable doubt, and we kind of need a do-over?
That's a big open question at this point. The Census Bureau doesn't have necessarily deadlines to set, doesn't have set legal deadlines for ending of counting, but it does have reporting deadlines. And December 31st is that key deadline. And the question is, does the Census Bureau have enough time to finish a count and also have enough time to process all those results to make sure that there aren't any duplicate results and do any type of cleaning necessary to make sure this is the most accurate data set possible. And the big question is also, are there going to be enough indicators and metrics for the Census Bureau as well as outside researchers to really make that assessment of how good is the 2020 census? How good are these results?
NPR's Hansi Lo Wang joining us from New York. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Hari.
Before the coronavirus pandemic changed everything, the summer of 2020 was going to be the time of the traditional days-long national political conventions. But as NewsHour Weekend special correspondent Jeff Greenfield reports, the conventions were already fading from the spotlight and their historic role years before COVID-19.
The strangest sound you will be hearing this month is the sound of silence. There will be no throngs of Democrats cheering the nomination of Joe Biden in Milwaukee. No crowds of Republicans celebrating President Trump in Charlotte, North Carolina, nor in Jacksonville, Florida, where the Republicans plan to decamp, the better to hold a more traditional convention. The persistence of the COVID-19 pandemic has forced both parties to abandon an event that has been a mainstay of American politics for close to two centuries, the National Nominating Convention. But in a larger sense, conventions have been on something close to life support for decades. From the first gatherings in 1831, through civil wars and world wars, through prosperity and depressions, this is how America's political parties have chosen their candidates and battled over the most significant of issues. It's where, in 1912, former President Theodore Roosevelt challenged his successor, President William Howard Taft, for the nomination, then led his supporters into a third party. It's where, in 1924, Democrats battled for 103 ballots before choosing a candidate, and where they fought over prohibition, immigration, and whether to condemn the Ku Klux Klan. It's where, in 1948, Democrats embraced the cause of civil rights after a rousing speech by Hubert Humphrey.
The time has arrived in America for the Democratic Party to get out of the shadows of states' rights and to walk forthrightly into the bright sunshine of human rights.
And where Southerners walked out and launched a segregationist third party that almost cost Harry Truman the White House. But it was the arrival of television that brought conventions into millions of American homes, complete with furious conflicts, rhetorical and physical. In 1952, with fights over dueling delegate slates and an angry denunciation by Illinois Senator Ev Dirksen of the party's last nominee, New York Governor Tom Dewey.
We followed you before. And you took us down the road to defeat.
Or the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, where violent clashes in the streets led to a frontal blast at Chicago Mayor Richard Daley.
And with George McGovern as President of the United States, we wouldn't have to have Gestapo tactics in the streets of Chicago.
And where a press credential was no protection.
I know you won't, but don't push me. Take your hands off of me unless you plan to arrest me.
And even without such high drama, conventions were often filled with political suspense. Would George McGovern get to keep all his delegates from California in 1972, the key to his nomination? Would Ronald Reagan 4 years later succeed in unseating President Gerald Ford? Would Ted Kennedy manage to keep his nomination hopes alive with a parliamentary maneuver? But that 1980 convention was the last gasp of anything approaching suspense. The primaries had already become the way the great majority of delegates were elected. No more brokers in smoke-filled rooms picking a nominee. No second or third ballots where alliances were formed or broken. There hasn't been a second ballot for a presidential nomination since 1952. And every 4 years, pundits proclaim that this time there will be a real contested convention, only to watch the nomination wrapped up weeks or months before the convention begins. That fact, in turn, has made conventions much less appealing to audiences and to TV networks. The multi-million-dollar investment in sky booths and an army of reporters and technicians has been scaled back in recent years, and the major broadcast networks devote less than an hour a night to the proceedings. There are no challenges to the rules or the platform or the credentials of delegates. About the only chance for surprise is when an obscure figure suddenly emerges into prominence, like this keynote speaker from 2004.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
4 years ago, the only remotely unscripted moment came when Senator Ted Cruz did not endorse Donald Trump and was roundly booed for it.
Freedom matters, and I was part of something beautiful.
Now the pandemic may have answered the question many have been asking for decades. Do we really need 4 days of meticulously scripted pageantry? Is there a point to an event which, like Main Street at Disney World, creates an essentially artificial reality? Or do we need to keep the conventions alive on the chance that some year, some decade, an unresolved primary fight may actually have to be resolved on the convention floor?
Finally, today marks the 75th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Nagasaki, Japan. At exactly 11:02 local time, bells rang out. That's the moment that an American B-29 bomber dropped a 10,000-pound plutonium bomb on the city, killing an estimated 70,000 people. That was 3 days after the nuclear bomb dropped on the city of Hiroshima. Within a week, on August 15, 1945, Japan surrendered, ending World War II. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.